From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. On the program today, in light of the discontent of the working class, some conservatives are thinking maybe unions do make sense if they could be tweaked.
We don't know what a modern model of unions looks like in the U.S. because it's been illegal to find out.
The Michigan governor got a so-called good jobs plan approved, but there were holdouts in his own party.
Kind of the big story is the fact that House Republican leaders, other Republicans, flat out didn't agree with him.
We'll talk to a woman who got job training to get into the workforce and then ran into another hurdle.
But then when I go out and try to get entry-level job, they're saying that I at least need like 2 years of college. I worked so hard for this, but it's still not enough.
We'll visit with our latest artisan of Michigan. She likes to get her hands dirty. Plus, WDIV's Kevin Dietz fills us in on parole for white boy Reg. But first, here's the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Later this hour, we'll hear how big data used to predict crime might be flawed.
I think there is a strong belief that data is objective. And when you talk about things, social phenomena like crime, right, it's not necessarily objective.
But first, after almost 30 years in prison, Rick Wershe, better known as White Boy Rick, has been paroled. Here to fill us in on the story is WDIV Local 4 reporter Kevin Dietz, who's been following this story for a long time. First, remind us who Rick Wershe is and how he ended up with a life sentence.
Rick Wershe really came to national attention because of his wild story. He was hired as a 14-year-old eighth grader by police and FBI agents. He would ride his bicycle around his East Side Detroit neighborhood and identify who drug dealers were for the police. The police paid him about $35,000 from the time he was 14 to the time he was 16 to give them information. Then they stopped paying him and stopped coming around. And when he ran out of money, he started selling drugs. So he sold drugs from age 16 to 17. He was busted at 17 with 8 kilos of cocaine, and he was sentenced to life in prison. He went in at 18, and he's been serving ever since. He's been in 29 years and 7 months. He is the longest-serving nonviolent juvenile offender in the entire history of Michigan.
I know there's been a lot of resistance to parole for him by law enforcement officials. Who argued for Rick Wershe to stay behind bars during the last parole hearing?
The last parole hearing was in 2003, and there were several police officers, law enforcement officials who came forward and said, Rick Wershe has been very cooperative. He's helped us put away some drug dealers, even some dirty cops. But there were also several people, Detroit police officers, DEA officers, a representative from the U.S. Attorney's Office, a representative from the Wayne County Prosecutor's Office, who all came forward against releasing Rick Wershe, saying he was just too dangerous of a person to let out. That was in 2003.
And what happened this time?
This time there was no resistance. Nobody came forward. The prosecutor's office said they were going to sit on the sidelines and let the parole board make up its own mind of what to do with Rick Wershe. And so when he had his hearing, there were several letters of support for Rick Wershe. There was no testimony from anyone who said that they wanted to see him stay locked up.
There was a recent documentary about White Boy Rick. How much impact do you think that might have had in today's decision?
It's interesting. It had an impact. You know, the media was covering this. It built up a little bit of a drumbeat. Then there was a documentary, and then the Hollywood cast Matthew McConaughey to play Rick Wershe's father in a major motion picture. I think it raised a lot of questions of why are you keeping him when rapists and murderers and child predators are being released, but this nonviolent offender is being locked up. And I think it put some pressure to get that hearing.
At this point, Rick Wershe is expected to be released from Michigan prison in August, but it looks as though he's going right back to jail. Tell us about that.
Yeah, he has he committed a crime while he was in prison 10 years ago. He was involved and pled guilty in a stolen crime ring. He introduced his sister to some people. His sister was looking for a car. He introduced some people to them. They ended up being stolen cars. His mom bought one. His sister bought one. And when the ring got busted, the prosecutor said, if you plead guilty, we won't charge your sister or your mom. And so he pled guilty to the crime. And so he owes about 22 months to the state of Florida. His attorney is going to go down and try and argue to have the sentences concurrent so that his time in Michigan would count for his time in Florida, and he wouldn't have to do that. But as it stands right now, he would have to go right to Florida and serve that time.
And as far as we know, they'd have to make that decision by August, the August release?
No, it's not a hard date. The Michigan Department of Corrections said that they're going to take about 30 to 90 days to figure it out, and they're going to notify Florida right away so Florida can make its decision. That's plenty of time for his attorneys to go down and file a motion and try and argue it. When I talked to Rick today, he said, look, I don't want to do prison time in Florida, but I don't care. I just wanted this life sentence off of my back. He said, the weight of the world has been lifted because I no longer have a life sentence on me. You can put whatever number of months you want now. I can do that because I can see the end of the tunnel. He had just tremendous amount of relief in his voice today when I spoke with him after finding out that he was paroled.
Again, Rick Wershey, White Boy Rick, has been awarded parole after 3 decades in prison. We've been talking with Kevin Dietz, investigative reporter at WDIV. Thanks very much.
You bet.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. We are in Grand Rapids for our ongoing series, Artisans of Michigan. When I got to her studio, Kate Lewis was adding to a big plastic bag of clay balls before she got to work at her pottery wheel.
It's easier to get them centered on the wheel. You want it to be kind of a perfect circle on the wheel. So I found if I start with a circle-ish shape, then I'm that much closer to getting where I need to be.
And you weighed each ball before you sat down to the wheel.
Yep. Today we're making 7-inch plates. So I found if I weigh out 1.25 pounds of clay, that's just about right.
Her business is named Kate Lewis Ceramics. She does ceramic art installations, but we're here to learn about her functional pottery, which includes jars, mugs, bowls, plates. She smacks down one of the balls of clay on a disc and turns on the pottery wheel. Her fingers press, guide, coax the clay into the shape she wants.
I think with clay, you have to find the balance between pushing it and getting it to do what you want it to do, and then being gentle with it and kind of just understanding how it's going to be shaped with your hands. Finding that balance is what I find interesting, where it's like you have to find the balance within yourself, and kind of helps with your personal practices as well as your pottery practices to find that balance.
This day she's making very simple rustic plates for the Sauvignarde restaurant. They'll be used to serve up smørrebrød. I hope I'm saying that right. It's a Nordic open-faced sandwich topped with meats, cheeses, and vegetables. This, pottery, is what she wanted to do since finishing college.
But I didn't fall in love with clay right away. Like, my first project dried out too much and I couldn't keep working on it. I had to start over, and I had this large project explode in the kiln, and my teacher told me I could glue it. It was like in 1,000 pieces maybe. And in the end, she let me just remake it, which was nice.
Prior to clay, she'd worked with jewelry, photography. This was different, but staying with the clay, getting a feel for it, won her over.
At the end of that first class, I just had really connected with the medium. And when I took the second class, which was focused on the pottery wheel, I thought, like, maybe I'm crazy, but I really feel like I'm a potter. Like, I feel like this is what I am.
But just being a potter has not been enough. She wanted to share her passion. And now she has what she calls her dream job. She teaches kids pottery at an after-school program at a community center. Lewis graduated from Michigan State University with a degree in fine arts and a second one in English. It took her several years before she realized she could combine her love for words with her ceramics by writing things on them. Writing on mugs. She even does what she calls hip-hop pottery with a local hip-hop artist.
I've been working with Dante Cope for a while, and even writing his album names on a mug, and then he uses that as the album cover. But the most requested quote from last year, once I wrote it on a mug, was, "You know that I'm the dopest." So after I made one of those, I had several requests. It's just a fun way for people to discover that there's a thriving hip-hop community in the city.
Kay Lewis says it's harder for her to sell her products than it is to make her products. She says she's definitely an introvert, and it took a while to learn to engage the people who were interested in her pottery when she's at street fairs or farmers markets. But she's learned to enjoy the interaction. She says there's one thing she has to tell everyone because of misperceptions, Yes, handmade pottery, when it's made right, the way she makes it, is microwave, dishwasher, and food safe. She says, handmade ceramics, a good way for you to enjoy art in your everyday life. Kate Lewis Ceramics, our latest Artisan of Michigan. Support for arts and culture coverage comes from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. By the way, I don't know if you heard, but Western Michigan University made some hires recently. Yeah, goats. By the way, this recording is not of those particular goats. Anyway, they're being used to clear undergrowth in a wooded area, including clearing up poison ivy. They'll eat just about anything. According to several reports, the union representing some of the employees has filed a grievance. And the Battle Creek Enquirer, a representative for the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, says those goats are taking away jobs from laid-off workers. The university says, not really, and the goats are an environmentally friendly way to clear out brush and weeds, and they're even ahead of schedule on the job. Goats. Constantly on lunch break and still getting paid. Still to come, a conservative's case for unions. Plus, the struggles of the working poor. A Detroit mom shares her story.
Like, no matter how much I tried to get ahead, I would end up falling again. It was like a vicious cycle.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. I know few political conservative-leaning people who find any use for organized labor. I've been told again and again that labor unions damaged the economy. They led to American corporations moving overseas. In short, unions hurt capitalism. So good riddance. But there are some conservatives that say, wait a minute, look at the discontent of workers today. They're angry, and with reason. And angry workers who feel they're not respected, that's not going to help America's economic prospects. An article in The Atlantic titled The Conservative Case for Unions takes a new look at labor unions. The author, Jonathan Rausch, joins us now. Your article starts with a personal story which got you thinking about how the American workers are treated today. So could you give us a quick description of what happened in your family?
Yeah, my husband last year took a job working for an international airline and almost immediately discovered what's called just-in-time scheduling, where he would be given a work shift schedule, and it was irregular, but at least you knew in advance, except then they would say, 3 days before we were scheduled to go to a wedding, you're going to work Saturday. And he'd say, but I wasn't scheduled to work. And they'd say, well, now you're working Saturday. There's absolutely nowhere he could go with this. His supervisor was as helpless as he was, and there's no one to talk to about it. So, of course, it was terribly disruptive for our family. But the bigger issue was kind of dignity, Lester. There's, you know, you just feel like a machine part. And maybe even the still bigger issue was it would have been so easy to improve the schedule with a little bit of worker input, but there was no channel to do that. So he wound up leaving the job, and I wound up getting a taste of what the modern workforce is like without unions.
Right. It's a commodity. Since the beginning of the conservative movement, though, since Barry Goldwater, unions have been a target. Today, right-to-work laws, such as the one passed in Michigan, are meant to diminish unions and, as a side effect, diminish funding for the Democrats. So why would conservatives not be celebrating the decline of labor unions?
Some conservatives have looked around at this profound anger and alienation and populism, which we're seeing in American politics, and its antagonism to free markets, to trade, to immigration, in many ways to business, not just in the U.S., but around the world. And they're saying, hey, wait a minute, you know, we may have made a mistake here. We may have gone too far by leaving workers in this state of feeling helpless and unable to have a sense of agency and dignity. And they're also pointing out that the old style of unions, which conservatives were so opposed to, are not the only way to do unions. In fact, they're a completely obsolete way to do unions. The reason we do them that way is that currently it's more or less illegal to do them any other way.
You suggest that there are union models that have worked to the betterment of not only workers but corporations. So could you give me a couple of examples?
Well, for example, in some of the Scandinavian countries, they use a model in which unions administer unemployment benefits. Now, you don't have to be a union member to get unemployment benefits. Of course, they're open to the public. But letting unions play this role gives people an incentive to connect with unions, a positive reason to do that. So you don't need the same kinds of heavy-handed laws that you have in the U.S. that can seem often coercive to get people into unions. Plus, you get to harness union special expertise, which is helping move people into jobs, train them with skills. Unions know a lot about employees and their needs and their skills. So in that system, one of many examples, why not put unions to work? Lots of other things unions could do. They could run pensions. They could sell training programs to employers. In principle, that's a felony right now. Lots of things unions could be doing to add value so that both the employer and the employee get added value.
Yeah, I was thinking, you know, the carpenters, the plumbers, the electrician unions, they've been training workers for a long time, but with private sector union membership down so much, that training's been lacking. And now construction companies find themselves without properly trained workers or not enough workers, period. I mean, how can we reverse that?
One of the big problems we have in the economy, Lester, is the problems with retraining and reskilling workers who get laid off because of downsizing or whatever, or who need skills increases in their jobs. Employers are often not the logical people to do that because if you upskill your employee, sometimes you're just training that person to go get a job for a competitor. Logical people to do job training are unions, and in some other countries, they do that. But again, here, that is not something that unions have done. But an important thing to know about all this is, so why is this happening? Why are we working with this outdated, anachronistic idea of unions?
Right. You mentioned the 1935 National Labor Relations Act. You said it's dysfunctional between unions and corporations.
Yeah, that's it. The law that governs unions in the United States is very strict and very rigid. It details exactly what unions can and cannot do, what employers can and cannot do. It says there cannot be substitutes, there cannot be models. A union, for example, cannot sell anything of value to an employer, even if the employer would like to buy services from unions. You can't have things that are called sort of workplace commissions short of full-scale unions that employees can use to consult with their employers. All of this is because union laws were written 70 years ago and have not been substantially updated.
You wrote that the collapse of unions has fueled the growth of government and the growth of the welfare state. Actually, the founder of a Republican-leaning think tank in Washington suggested that. Can you explain how that might be?
The thinking here, I need to credit to a man named Eli Lehrer, who's the president of something called the R Street Institute, which is a free market-oriented, Republican-leaning think tank in Washington that's interestingly trying to update a lot of these laws and regulations. And what Eli points out is that there are things that need to happen. You need to have some sense of job security. You need to have some training and reskilling to make a workforce operate. Well, if unions are not in a position to do those things, because private sector unions are down to 6% of the workforce, they're basically negligible, government tends to step in and do it instead. So he believes that the decline of unions has actually fueled the growth of government. Now, that's hard to demonstrate, but it's a very interesting and challenging point for conservatives who just want to make unions go away.
I'm wondering what kind of response you've gotten to this article.
Well, I got a legislator in one state wrote in and said, so what can we do in our state to change this right now so that unions in my state can modernize? And I thought that was interesting. I've gotten some positive responses from some conservatives. A lot of people, though, just say, you know, they're conservatives. They say, you know what? Unions are our enemy. They support Democrats. We are against them. They think about it very tribally, which I think is short-sighted.
I'm wondering what you, how you responded to that legislator.
Well, I sent him to a legal expert because, of course, the law would depend on the state, and I'm not a lawyer. But I also said the problem here is that federal law gets in the way. There's very little that states can do by way of innovation at the moment because this 1930s statute spells out in detail what can go on. So what I came out for, I think it's one of the best policy ideas I've seen in years, is something that Eli Lehrer and a retired union leader named Andy Stern, very famous in the labor movement, have come up with. And that says, tell you what, we don't know what a modern model of unions looks like in the U.S. because it's been illegal to find out. And the idea of rewriting federal labor law from scratch is a complete non-starter in Congress. So why don't we pass waivers and let states do it. Why don't we tell them if they meet certain requirements, then a state can allow employers and employees to do something innovative, and we'll see how it works. We'll let these experiments blossom around the country, and then with things start to work, then we can expand those things. I think it's just a great idea.
Jonathan Rausch is a senior fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution and contributing editor of The Atlantic. His article in The Atlantic is titled "The Conservative Case for Unions: How a New Kind of Labor Organization Could Address the Grievances Underlying Populist Anger." Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you. It's great to be here, Lester.
We're working on a new project to bring you voices that you might not hear that often. People who are working to bring their lives from the economic bottom to independence. Ethel Rucker is from Detroit. She has 4 kids, 2 girls, 2 boys. And after a divorce, she's struggled. Ethel, thanks for joining us.
Oh, no problem. Thank you for having me.
Tell us what happened to you and your family after your divorce.
Well, after I was divorced, I was trying to get back on my feet. I would start a job, and then my sons, they would have problems in school. So I repeatedly have to step aside to get on the phone to talk to the teachers, or other things would happen. And I would end up either losing the job or getting in trouble because of that. And that ultimately what led me into being in the shelter. Like, no matter how much I tried to get ahead, I would end up falling again. It was like a vicious cycle.
Right. You didn't go directly to the shelter first, right? I mean, you had a couple of houses and you weren't able to keep them?
Yes, I was able to keep them for a few months, but then the bills started coming in, and I'm a single mother, so trying to pay the bills, work, and having to get off of work because of issues I was having with my children, and I could never keep it for more than a year or even 6 months at times. So it was always a challenge.
So you've not always been able to keep a roof over your head.
Right.
You got a certificate to become a computer repair technician, but then you find out you need more than a certificate to get a job in that field. So what happened?
Yes, I went to Job Corps, and I actually obtained my A+ certification in computer repair. And that was challenging in itself, because me being a single mother and going to school, I thought, yes, as soon as I get this certificate, it should be enough for me to at least get an entry-level job. But then when I go out and try to get entry-level job, they saying that I at least need 2 years of experience in college, like 2 years of college. And I'm like, man, so it's like I worked so hard for this, but it's still not enough, you know? And that was kind of devastating. But it just goes back to I wish I would just how important education is. And if I would have got my education and went to college and at least got my associates, I wouldn't have had that problem.
Did you graduate from high school?
I got my GED at Job Corps.
Okay, good. So how difficult have you been able to get the additional schooling that you need to get the kind of job you want?
Well, I've been having a lot of support, especially from the Passport to Self-Sufficiency. I worked with LaTanya Walker. She's my life coach there. And I also am a part of the Warrior Women Against Poverty, which I have a mentor there. And one of the Warrior Women, her name is Diane Green. She's actually my counselor at Henry Ford Community College. And she's been very proactive in making sure I stay ahead of my classes and everything like that. So they've been really big at helping me with going back to college.
How did you find those people to give you the support that you need at this point?
Well, it was actually with going to COTS.
That's the Coalition of Temporary Shelter, right?
Yes, sir. That's the homeless shelter. And it was one of the hardest decisions I made, because I feel that as a mother, I'm supposed to provide for my children, and not being able to do that and have to go into the shelter, it was really hard for me, but it was definitely a blessing for me and my children, because I got this extra support, and I got the support from being in there. And that's where I linked up with LaTanya Walker. I'm in the Passport to Self-Sufficiency program there. And that's how I got the extra support.
So when will you be finished with school?
Projected 2018, maybe 2019, and that's getting my associate's. I'm trying to go for my bachelor's degree in computer science.
What are you doing in the meantime to find your way to independence?
Well, right now, I'm actually working right now, and I'm taking off the spring and summer, but I'm going to go back to school in the fall.
You told one of the producers that the last couple of years have been the most stable that you and your children have had. Is it because of that support service you're getting?
For sure, 100%, 100%, definitely. It's because of that. This has been the most stable I've been, me and my children. I've been able to maintain my household. I've been able to maintain my job and look towards the future, which is going, I mean, my main thing is I wanted to go to college, and having their support, they're supporting me with my dreams. And it's been amazing. It's such a blessing to have them in my life, for sure.
I want to clear something up. So are you still living in Cots, or you have your own place now?
Oh, no, sir. I've been out for 2 years. I'm in my own home now. I've been out since 2015, and I've been able to sustain it since then.
Tell me about your long-term goals for your family.
Long-term goals is me being college educated, my children going to wonderful schools, and me being truly self-sufficient, meaning no DHS, no kind of housing assistance or anything. It's nothing wrong with that because they helping me now, but long-term, I want to be able to be self-sufficient in a way where I can truly take care of my family without any government assistance.
You mentioned finishing with your associate's degree in 18 or 2019. Do you think you'll be far enough along on that long-term goal to have real independence?
I'm working really hard with it now, but it will have some things will have to change. Like, it's still, even though I have stable housing right now, it's still a challenge with my children in their schools because I have two boys with ADHD. So, but I still have challenges with their teachers calling me or with their administrators and me having to deal with that. And that can ultimately affect my employment or what have you because I'm single. So I have to take care of those things. So I don't know how long, because I'm steady working towards that. I'm projecting, I'm hopefully praying within the next 5 years, it will be something that I will be able to accomplish. But I'm working hard towards that.
You know, when you think about your future, when you think about your goals, I know you have this difficulty with the schools calling. What could trip you up? What could get you off the path of your goals? What keeps you up at night?
You know what? At this point, I can honestly answer and truly say nothing. Since I have the support of my coach, Miss Latoya Walker, my mentor, Miss Pearlann Pallard, and the staff at COTS and the Warrior Women Against Poverty Mentoring Group, I can honestly say that I don't feel that it's nothing that can stop me now because I have that extra support where, okay, if I can tell Miss Walker, all right, I have this issue, okay, then we will work together towards any issue that I'm having. And that's just like something that's so amazing. And I never had this feeling before. This is the most stable I've been these last 2 years. And I look forward to the future now because I have this extra support. I don't have to worry as much because I know there's someone there that's actively working with me to be self-sufficient and for the success of my family. And it's just so wonderful to have.
Well, Ethel Rucker, we wish the best for you and your family and good luck on your goals.
Oh, thank you so much.
Coming up, we'll talk about whether law enforcement agencies need to better screen the police report data used by predictive policing. That's in 10 minutes. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Lester Graham. Joining us as they do most Fridays are Ken Sikkema, Senior Policy Fellow with Public Sector Consultants and the former Republican Majority Leader in the State Senate, and Vicki Barnett, a former mayor of Farmington Hills and a former Democratic legislator. Governor Snyder got what he wanted from the legislature this week, a so-called good jobs tax incentive. If a business creates enough good wage jobs, it can keep the money that employees pay in income tax. Ken, a lot of business groups are applauding. A lot of conservative groups and some conservative legislators are giving it a thumbs down. What are the pros and cons?
This is the exact debate, Lester, that occurred 25 years ago in the early days of John Engler as governor, when he campaigned against these kind of incentives, got elected governor, and realized that in order for Michigan to compete with other states, you had to have them. And the result is exactly the same, in the sense that a majority of Republicans and a majority of Democrats in the state house agreed and passed it. The difference is the House leadership, their particular brand of conservative politics, forced them to vote against it. In the past, 25 years ago, the entire House Republican leadership voted for it. So I think that kind of the big story is the fact that House Republican leaders, other Republicans, flat out didn't agree with them.
Vicki, the governor says we need this tool to compete with other states for businesses. We've heard this before for all kinds of business tax breaks. Are these kinds of incentives effective?
It depends on what you're aiming for and what you want to do. Now, here's a governor that came into office in 2010, was sworn in 2011, and said, we're going to get rid of these tax incentives that pit businesses against communities, and we're going to instead change the entire tax system and give business owners a lower tax rate, a sure tax rate. We're going to get rid of the wild calculations of the previous MBT, Michigan Business Tax, and we're going to come in with a new tax plan. And then eventually we got to the point where we eliminated personal property taxes for businesses. So all of these taxes were eliminated for businesses, and putting pension tax on residents and raising taxes for others and eliminating tax breaks for very poor, hardworking individuals, the earned income tax credit. And now we see that he's changed his tune again and now wants business incentives for businesses on top of all of the other tax breaks, which clearly didn't do the job that the governor had wanted them to do. And so I understand the quandary that legislators are in who really want to end the pension tax for our seniors, and now they're stuck with another good jobs package. Personally, I think the good jobs package is a good package. I think it's needed. I wish it had been targeted toward industries that weren't here yet instead of other existing industries. I was a strong proponent of the film tax incentives and the digital industry tax incentives that were done away with early in Governor Snyder's career as governor. So I'm not opposed to tax breaks. I just think that this is a wild swing for a governor that has only been in office for 7 years.
Let's move on to another topic. The Department of Health and Human Services has been operating under a court order terms agreed to in a lawsuit. That lawsuit was filed by an advocacy group after deaths of kids in the care of the state. Recently, the department announced it was making good progress on the mandates of that court order. And then the Lansing State Journal started reporting that state child welfare supervisors manipulated employee caseload data to make Michigan appear to be in compliance with the court order. Ken, what's this say about Michigan's Health and Human Services Department?
Well, as you pointed out, this is a Lansing State Journal article that basically says the caseload for child welfare workers violates the federal court order. And the leadership in the department is disputing that. So you have an allegation, you have a difference of opinion, and you've got a federal judge who has control over this. You've got a federal monitor appointed by the federal judge. You've got House and Senate committees saying they're going to investigate. I mean, it's basically now getting at the truth of the matter. I mean, does the current caseload violate the federal court order or not?
Vicki, the Lansing State Journal has a lot of documentation for caseloads that were assigned to people not actually on the job. What does that mean for the kids who were the subjects of those files?
It's a devastating article in the Lansing State Journal. And not only does it list sources, it lists them by name. So clearly there are a lot of whistleblowers ready to come forward and talk about this issue and how they view it. And they're not afraid to use their own name and their own and stake their own reputation on it, which is what was so striking about this. This is an ongoing story. We had people come forward that were reported in the Lansing State Journal a few months ago about how the computer program used to track these cases is not accurate and kids are falling behind. They've talked to other caseload workers, and they've got ghost cases, which are cases that should have been closed that don't exist, or cases that were moved to them temporarily to show an even caseload distribution where there wasn't one. There have been reports of people being drug tested who lost their parental rights due to drug addiction who have not actually been tested. So there are a lot of problems here, and I think Ken is right. There's allegations. Now we have to get to the bottom of the allegations and find out what is true and what isn't. But it's very, very serious when you have the lives of children on the line. And this is not the only failure of this particular department. Don't forget, we now have criminal charges brought against the director for failure to protect the health, safety, and welfare of the citizens of Flint in the Flint water debacle. And we have these ongoing problems. I hope that they get resolved soon, and I'm glad that the legislature oversight is willing to step forward and demand information.
Ken, what kind of power does the legislature or an investigative committee have in a situation like this?
Well, legislative committees have a lot of power because they control policy under which the department has to operate, and they control the budget for the department. So I wouldn't discount any legislative investigation on this issue. And on top of that, you have the federal judge who has jurisdiction and the federal monitor appointed by the federal judge. So I've got to believe that the truth of the matter is going to get unveiled here pretty quickly. I mean, as Vicki said, I mean, clearly it's a serious charge and allegation. You got the lives of children at stake.
That's Ken Sikkim, a senior policy fellow with Public Sector Consultants and a former Republican legislator. He joined us by Skype. We also heard from Vicki Barnett, a former mayor of Farmington Hills and a former Democratic legislator. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Have a great weekend.
You too.
Thanks, Lester.
Police departments across the nation are using new methods to try to predict where crime is likely to happen, who's more likely to become a victim of crime, or who might become a criminal. Predictive policing is already being used across the nation. There are a lot of different approaches, and it is not without its critics for a variety of reasons. William Isaac is a PhD candidate in political science at Michigan State University. He, along with Andy Dixon, wrote an article published in The Conversation about using big data analysis for predictive policing. William, first of all, let's talk about what exactly this is. How are we using big data to predict what police might want to watch for?
Well, you know, I think this is part of a larger movement. I think what a lot of people call intelligence-led policing. And at its core, it's essentially we're using historical trends in, you know, police recorded data to try to identify or better allocate the policing resources that departments have. And usually they come in a variety of shapes and flavors, but primarily it's ones that are focused on trying to identify neighborhoods or locations where they think crime are likely to occur. And then there are person-based models which try to use data on arrests to identify individuals that might perpetrate a crime in the future. And then less...
Or their associates.
Or their associates, yes. Yeah. Or their associates. And then the last kind of category, which is less common, are instances where they're trying to identify potential victims of crimes. But, you know, kind of all of these are kind of embedded within using police data to try to generate these predictions.
So your concern is not so much about whether machine learning algorithms will work. It's more about the data that are put into the algorithm. What's the concern?
Well, you know, I think there is a strong belief that data is objective. And when you talk about things, social phenomena like crime, right, it's not necessarily objective. It's an interaction of people actually going and committing crimes, but also, you know, police officers and departments, their strategies, their priorities in a given moment in time, and also kind of things like implicit bias or factors that are actually within individual officers as they try to make decisions on the ground about, you know, what actions to take.
Let me stop you just for a second. So what do you mean by implicit bias?
So, you know, at its core, I mean, officers maybe don't intentionally try to target certain groups more than others, but you know, if you have a history of being told this neighborhood is a bad neighborhood or these groups of individuals are always gang affiliated, that even if you're not explicitly trying to target certain groups, you might just be on patrol and say, you know what, I just made a quick decision, and that decisions tend to, over time, if you look at it, tends to, you know, overrepresent certain groups than others.
You know that neighborhoods with lots of police calls are not necessarily the same places where the most crime is happening. Could you explain that to us?
When we talk about reporting versus crime, you know, there's a decision that gets to be made about, you know, what types of instances are actually recorded and documented. And, you know, sometimes when you have, like, instances, like, I find common places, like basketball game or something, where you have lots of 911 calls about people having, you know, like, instances of, oh, my cell phone got stolen or something happened. But that may not necessarily correlate with a lot of crime in the area. And vice versa, right? I mean, a lot of times, you know, observed crimes come from patrols. And you know, officers go to certain neighborhoods they think are high crime. And they might be a lot of recorded crime, but not a lot of actual 911 calls, because in those areas, a lot of people are actually kind of afraid to bring the police involved, and when they, because they're afraid of negative consequences from the police if they come into those neighborhoods.
So there are these different implicit bias, experiential bias. If there are these biases, in what ways can we get past that and make this data useful? Because that hard predictive policing sounds like it could be a really good thing.
Absolutely. And I think a lot of times, when talking about this kind of issue, I don't want to say that data is bad or that data does not have potential benefits. It has immense benefits, especially for cities like, you know, we see across the Midwest who have tight financial situations and actually need to expand and best utilize their public resources. And one of the ways in which I think they can actually, you know, kind of use this data is to, you know, I think of it as that, one, think about what are we actually measuring, right? I mean, in a lot of cases, right, we see a lot of, you know, instances of reported crimes by the police. One idea is to maybe send more cops to make more arrests. Another idea might be to take models that we've seen in Canada and other places, which try to incorporate more community policing to actually incorporate other types of public resources into an issue.
Now, we've heard a lot about community-oriented policing recently in the wake of Baltimore and Ferguson and some of the many other towns that found themselves under the auspices of the Department of Justice that are keeping an eye on them because of problems within those communities. President Trump's budget threatens funding for the Office of Community-Oriented Policing Services. It's called COPS for short. It's part of the Department of Justice. The Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, has indicated that that's not a priority for him. He doesn't see racial bias as a big problem in police forces, which is a big concern for a lot of people who are keeping their eyes on this. So you're proposing that, hey, if you're going to continue using this science-based kind of stuff, keep in mind that the data in, it's garbage in, garbage out, so you've got to make sure that you've got good data in an era where it appears that racial bias is not a concern of the Department of Justice, or at least as much of a concern as it once was. Are you running uphill on this?
You know, in some ways, yes, in some ways, no. And, you know, ironically, I think as the federal government is moving away from this kind of community-oriented policing, I think actually local departments are moving towards it, especially ones that are adopting data. So, you know, for example, there's a report by RAND that actually tested.
I read a good deal of that. Yeah,
exactly. And one of the things they outline is that data alone can actually not solve this problem. And what they found is that if you just adopted a tool, the police departments they surveyed didn't actually see a measurable drop in crime. It was when they actually incorporated better strategies of interacting with the community, modifying how officers actually intervened when they're in a hotspot area. That's when they actually saw drops in the crime rate. And actually, I think more cities that are adopting this are now trying to at least think about, okay, you know, we know that there's some overrepresentation. Can we put, you know, an officer who maybe serves as a buffer between crime analysts and officers on the ground who can say, hey, you know, you're going into this neighborhood, right? You know, like, think about, you know, how you're going to respond.
It's interesting you mentioned that, because just a couple of weeks ago, I was in a ride-along with a Detroit officer, a neighborhood police officer, which is their version of community policing. And we were stopping and getting out and talking to people in their yards and letting them know you know, hearing about their complaints. And they're glad to see the neighborhood police officer. Yeah. They wish they had more slow rolls through the community.
Yeah.
How does all of that work together? The predictive policing models that you're talking about, eliminating the bias and making it work for this trend by police departments toward community-oriented policing?
Well, you know, I think one great example, and I think this is kind of encapsulated, is that I think in response to our initial study, there was the people who, the vendors who created the software said, well, we don't use this, we don't use predictive models for drug crimes. But my counter to that was that when you say, well, we only focus on property crimes or violent crimes, there's a lot of other types of crimes that impact communities that don't get counted as high crime. But when you have officers who go into neighborhoods, they're able to say, you know what, I don't see a lot of robberies in here, but I see a lot of, you know, other crimes that I say, okay, the community is really concerned about this. We need to put, you know, I know the data is telling me this is a particular high crime area for this type of crime, but we probably need to be thinking more about this. And so they're able to discount what they're seeing in the data and actually be able to incorporate a more holistic understanding of what's going on in the community, because data doesn't capture a lot of the dynamics that's going on and by its very nature. And so by having officers in the communities interacting with people, they get a better sense of what data is important and what's not.
The final point you made was about transparency. You say we can't leave it up to law enforcement or the companies working on this software to serve law enforcement to assure that their predictive police models are bias-free. It must be transparent, the process. How can that be done?
Well, you know, I think there's a lot of ways to do this. You know, this is kind of a relatively complex subject. Basically, I think the standard has been, well, if you just release your algorithm and, you know, let other people independently verify it, then that's the solution. And they say, well, this is proprietary, this is a trade secret. But I think there are models in which we could do that. Just like companies, when they have, you know, their annual reports, they have an auditor come in and check their financial situation. You could do the same thing with, you know, predictive policing. You could have independent kind of evaluators come in, assess the model without actually disclosing any proprietary information to determine that there's constant monitoring. And I think that's important as we go forward, because there is a gap, especially among smaller police departments who don't have the resources to allocate to a specific person for, you know, analyzing crime data, right, to assess these things independently. And so I think having that kind of system is kind of critical for the expansion of this kind of intelligence policing approach.
William Isaac is a PhD candidate in political science at Michigan State University, and Andy Dixon, a PhD candidate in communications at Columbia University. They wrote the article, Why Big Data Analysis of Police Activity is Inherently Biased, and you can find that at theconversation.com. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Lester.
Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings and engineered by Rusty Brock, who was right twice today. That never happens. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mercedes Mejia, Mike Blank, Lindsay Scullin, Josh Hakala, and Tyler Scott. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.